guest today is one of Britain's most significant, important, charismatic and influential figures, Ron Dennis. And Ron Dennis has been a dominant figure in motor racing, Formula One, cars for 50 years. And he also, summit of his career, was to be a very long-serving and very distinguished governor of Wellington College. So, Ron, thank you very much for joining us today. And what is it, Ron, that makes you tick?
Interesting question. Well, first, I'll start with trying to explain what got me out of bed from a very early age to even to today. I am a very early riser, and I carry the burden of being a compulsive obsessive, which has created the driving force in my character from the very beginning. When you wrestle with this, I would say, positive affliction, you have to come to terms with the fact that you have to turn it into a driving force, a constructive driving force. Otherwise, it manifests itself in many destructive ways, be it anorexia or ritualistic behaviors or the other spin-off versions. If you turn it to a positive, and in my instance, I turned it into what I call attention to detail, and then it becomes a positive influence in how you think and how you react.
Well, you are indeed a force of nature. Did you, going way back, 1966, local boy, grew up in Woking, went to Guildford Technology College, and then in 1966, you joined the Cooper Formula team, came across Jochen Rindt, who was to die 4 years later. Can you just tell us, why did you always want to go into motorsport? And what was the impact of Cooper Formula One on you?
Well, first of all, in life, there are pivotal moments. And in my life, it was that pivotal moment came when my work ethic, which saw me by choice working 12 hours a day, that was often longer by choice, was noticed by a very suave former racing driver called Roy Salvadori.
Mm.
He gave me the opportunity of going on to the Formula One team at a very, very early age. I was 18, 19, just turned 19 when I went to my first Grand Prix.
I think you remember which one that was?
It's interesting. I did get a bit confused over that, but I think it was Mexico.
So many.
There's a lot of Grand Prix that got under the water, under the bridge, as it were. But I think the real aspect of motor racing was that it was seeing people's efforts to be the best in the world. And I always aspired to try and be the best in the world at anything I do. It's a big ambition, but I don't think it's an ambition that can't be shared. I mean, anybody in a team, and team is the operative word, can feel that they're the best in the world. It's not necessarily an individualistic emotion. Building a team, you know, for example, look at the importance that's now placed on the manager of a football team. Very often they talk more about the manager of a football team than they do about the players. And normally the fans are far more subjective in their opinion. They're saying we aren't winning because of the manager. So the reality is, team is everything, and communicating a team spirit and developing the values of the team in such a way that, you know, I used to say at McLaren, if I cut you after 6 months and you don't bleed McLaren, leave. And people would people would get that. And they did.
Now, tell us about Jochen Rindt, who in 1968 moved to Brabham, and Team Lotus took you with him. Tell us about Jochen Rindt and his impact on you.
Just to create, he moved. I moved to Brabham with him. His request. Okay. And he subsequently moved from Brabham to Lotus.
Team Lotus.
And I didn't move with him.
You stayed. Absolutely. So and, the influence of who was, why was Jochen Rindt such an extraordinary figure? Just tell us about him. Well, how is he known now?
In that era, the payments to drivers was extremely low. No commercial sponsorship, and the income, primary income for a Grand Prix team, was being paid by the organisers of the race. And I don't think there was, without doubt, there wasn't a Grand Prix team making money. Every Grand Prix lost money. It's only a question of how was that loss covered. And then Colin Chapman was the first. Of course, you had petrochemical companies, these sorts of people, the tire companies, but their contribution was minimal to the initial sponsorship that Lotus attracted, which was obviously from one of the tobacco companies. He led the charge of the tobacco companies in motorsport. But the world's
without that money, would motorsport have taken off without tobacco?
Probably not. But you know, it came and went over many years, and I would say I still carry a bit of guilt. But of course, at that time, the tobacco companies were very adept at explaining all the reasons why there was nothing wrong with smoking. It was only when the science stepped in that you started to feel pretty guilty about the fact that you were part of a process that you weren't particularly proud of.
So you then, that experience, Rindt moved on. He died in 1970. As you said, there were a whole succession of immensely talented drivers who lost their lives. What were the main safety changes that came in and that would have meant they would still be alive today?
Well, I think the turning moment was when the company, the small company that I had formed, following the establishment of my own business, and in fact, it was two or three iterations, but the iteration at the time was a company that I called Project 4. Mm-hmm. And within that company, we developed the first carbon fiber Formula One car. And the structural qualities that we were seeking to benefit from were really for the performance of the car. But as we optimized the primary structure of the car, which was made of carbon fiber, as a byproduct of that optimization, we created a safety cell. And really, the all cars up until that point would disintegrate to certain levels according to the level and nature of the accident. Once the carbon fiber car had been developed, primary structure called the monocoque. Effectively, the driver had a survival cell, and then from that, all sorts of energy-absorbing structures were developed, so that the result being that, so in the last 24 years, the survival rate of the of drivers gone up by 91%. There's been a 91% improvement in survival in the last 25 years. There's only three drivers have lost their lives since 1981. And I would say that without doubt, the primary reason for that is the development of carbon fiber in Formula One. And now every car in motor racing is pretty much made from carbon fiber, and some production cars too.
So John Hogan and Philip Morris, really very impressed with you. You put fresh energy into McLaren, the MP41 fiber composite chassis coming forward. You are really now beginning to take off. Can you just say a word about the state of McLaren? For those who don't know, the McLaren, why it was, how the McLaren company came to exist.
Well, the company was founded by Bruce McLaren, who had died in a testing accident 2 or 3 years prior to my involvement. They had success with both James Hunt and Emerson Fittipaldi. But they, you know, the flywheel of their success started to slow. I would say some of the decision making wasn't particularly well done, and they became vulnerable to the approach that I took. And I don't think they realized that naked ambition I had or the determination to lead. But I didn't do it in an aggressive way.
No. And just a word there on James Hunt, amongst the many extraordinary galaxy of charismatic, brilliant drivers. There we have James Hunt, old Wellingtonian, who unusually went into a career in racing. What was special about James Hunt? Was he more maverick than usual, or was he just typically maverick, Ron?
Well, first of all, he drove for McLaren and had retired at the point I became involved in McLaren. But I knew him very well because he was an ambassador. He continued to be an ambassador and a TV presenter. I mean, I think if I was being polite, I would say he was very wayward. And his style in motor racing, you know, it wouldn't have sat well in terms of the values and principles that I thought were essential in motor racing. But in fairness to him, when you look at the numerous number of drivers that drove for McLaren and for my team, they were very, very different and had to be, because the requirements of success vary time and time again.
Yeah, I remember, Ron, how struck I was when you showed me around the MTC a few years ago by the absolute reverence about data that was drilled home to me time and again by all the people I met. I want to just have a quick word about two key decisions for you in the early 1980s. The first about Porsche and how that the turbocharged engine then led on to THG. What was in your mind there?
Well, it was very simple. The governing body constantly changes the rules, and but in that era, I wouldn't say there were many rule changes for safety. But most of the rule changes were to try and make sport either more attractive to the automotive manufacturers to participate, or more exciting. And they opened the door to turbocharged engines, smaller capacity engines, turbocharged. And of course, there wasn't a great deal of expertise where most of the racing engine people didn't have the knowledge because it wasn't relevant to the sport. And first of all, Renault started to develop engines, and then BMW. And there was not much appetite for turbocharged engines in production cars, but there was a great appetite in demonstrating to the world that they had better knowledge, better expertise. And the only company that had really mastered turbocharged engines being in production cars, or let's say pioneered and optimized, was Porsche. So I thought a logical place to go to get this expertise was Porsche. And not surprisingly, they weren't too interested in giving it to me. And I was, but I did convince them that if I paid, they were, you know, the engineering group at Vizark, the research facilities, it was music to their ears. Someone would actually pay for them to develop an engine. The only problem is I didn't have the money. And but I came up with the idea of saying, well, would they, if they designed the engine, how long would it take them to design the engine and how much would it cost, assuming that all they were doing was doing some development work, but also mainly drawing the engine. And they said, oh, it would take them about 6 months. And I asked them how much it would cost. And let's say in today's money, it would be I would imagine £1 million or something. In then those days, it was like 150 or something like that. And I said, okay, well, I'll give you the money to develop to design the engine, and I'll come back in 6 months to sign the contract to develop the engine. And in that 6 months, I managed to convince TAG to provide the funding for the development of the engine. But I actually carried the burden of the maintenance in the company. So it was a very innovative way to get a competitive turbo engine.
It certainly was. And you, in your private life, Ron, were you driving a 911 turbo at this time? What was the Ron Dennis car of choice?
Coincidentally, yes, but it was more coincidence than anything else.
And was that one of your favourite cars? When you could, when you started making serious money in the 1970s, what was the car you most wanted to buy and you were most excited about having in your drive?
Anthony, you're not the first person to hear this. I actually don't have much interest in cars. The simple fact is I love making beautiful things, and I appreciate the beautiful things. So for me, it was more either the styling of a car or the engineering of a car that attracted to me. Driving the car wasn't that really relevant, other than did it have the appropriate performance for in terms of how it was designed. And actually making cars, which happened later in my career, it was very much driven by form following function. I think that the aesthetics of a car must relate to how the vehicle performs. I remember there's a very famous plane called, nicknamed Blackbird SR-72, I think it was. What a beautiful piece of engineering, and you look, and it was designed specifically to fly very high, very fast, take photographs, never carried weapons, and you just go, that's the most awesome thing ever, you know. And that was always a driving force for me, and the fact is, it didn't matter what it was. If you're going to make it really, really well, and try and make it better than anybody else.
Of course, for sure. But Ryan, you're going to press you on this before I come on to back to the early 80s and Niki Lauda. So I'm going to press you on, what is the car you must have enjoyed driving? Some car. What would just give us one car that you really enjoyed driving?
Well, the very first production car. First real production car was an MP412C, but I did make a car. Was a team, the company made a car called an F1. That was an iconic car. The production run was meant to be 300. In fact, we ended up making a rather oddball number of 103 or 106, can't remember. But those cars, it was the first car that was sold for $1 million, which is a ginormous amount of money. I launched it straight into a depression. I can't remember what circumstances were, why the world was fiscally depressed at the moment. at that time. But I do remember having to cut production to what was going to be 100 plus the development cars. And now those cars, they're so rare, they command a value something north of £20 million. So it would have been a good investment if you'd bought the car for $1 million in those days.
If only we could go back. Nicky Lauda, you persuaded him, retired Lauda, to come back into F1 for the 82 season. Tell us about that. Tell us about Lauda.
Nicky was an unusual animal, but he was quite entrepreneurial. And after he stopped, he was obsessed with planes. He was the first driver to have his own jet, flew his own jet, and then came up with the idea of forming Lauda Air. Of course, you don't suddenly go out and buy a bunch of aircraft when you've just got relatively modest income. He probably had a few million, probably single-digit millions in the bank, but he managed to leverage himself and started to run a fleet of aircraft. And he once said to me, these aircraft, he personally supervised every aspect of the aircraft. And if he would fly the planes himself. I don't know how many he got, it probably got up to six, I think. I can't even remember the mix he had.
Yeah.
Because he got into a bit of problems. And I think there was a bit of financial pressure, but also I think it was bored. It didn't actually hit the adrenaline rush. And I coerced him back into, he had driven for me in a sports car series, and I'd coerced him back into motor racing and told him that we were developing the Porsche engine, et cetera, et cetera. And we had lots of fights, but there was a lot of mutual respect.
The extraordinary year, 1984, with Prost joining Lauda. I mean, in 4 years, you'd created this extraordinary company with these world-class winning drivers. Was that a very special year, 84? And what was it about Prost that made him so special?
I would say every year was special because I'm a forward-thinking person. You know, I think you can learn from the past, but don't live in the past. And too many people do that. The important thing is to look forward. And what I had there was two drivers who worked hard on being team players. But of course, at the end of the day, drivers are selfish. They want to win. And when you have two top drivers, you know, they are a handful. And the only time they're not a handful is when they're young, because then you can be more dictatorial. But when they're developed existing world champions, they are a real handful, because then they have a completely different level of, let's say, aggressivity and desire. So I look back on the various driver mixes, you know, I would say the most difficult one being Prost and Senna. That was a very challenging mix of two very...
Let's come on to Senna, obviously. An extraordinary figure, made known to non-F1 people through the his life and the film in which the documentary. Senna was a genius. What was he like to work with?
He was of his time. You know, we had one thing in common, was the understanding of sacrifice and the understanding of what it takes to win. It requires 100% commitment. And the sacrifice comes in is the things that you don't have in your life. You know, if the driver is very young, becoming into motorsport, especially if they're young coming into Formula One, is to the detriment of their education, the detriment of their childhood. They are not very well equipped very often to manage themselves in certain, let's say, social situations, and you have to guide them. But with mature drivers, and Senna was a mature driver when he came, it's a different thing altogether. They have a focus, this laser-like focus, and his inherent self-belief. They all have self-belief, but you know, a driver has to be able to blame the car if they're not succeeding. You have to be able to accept, you know, they have to have the self-belief. If I had the car, I would win. I mean, and the only thing that would keep a driver honest is if their teammate was winning and they weren't. Mm-hmm. And that's one of the ingredients you get when you get two incredibly talented drivers, that's Austin Senna as well, you know, they would trade race wins, and therefore the efforts of the team to provide equality really increased. Equality was very hard to achieve in a Grand Prix cars. Repeatability and consistency of performance is key in any successful environment. You go back to Senna, he understood that and did the work. So he wouldn't get out of the car and go to the hotel. He would get out of the car, work with the engineers, collect all the data, go back to the hotel and sit looking at all the data, trying to understand why the car was behaving in the way it was based on the data.
Moving on, end of the 90s finished really well for McLaren. You won the constructors' title. You had Adrian Newey, of course, and you won the driver's title with Mika Hakkinen. And then into the noughties, along comes Lewis Hamilton. Lewis Hamilton, what's that, a father and son relationship compared to the brother relationship with Ayrton Senna?
Yeah, stepson, because of course his father was very influential on Lewis's career, and inevitably, and it's not. Anthony is not alone in terms of parents wanting to vicariously live the lives of their sons or daughters. And but you know, I met Lewis when he was 10. When he asked for my autograph, I contracted him, I think, at maybe 12. And financed his career in terms of initially karting, and then the various other lesser categories of motor racing, Formula 4, Formula 3, what was then, I think, Formula 3000. I can't remember which category it was, the second category. And then ultimately, I gave him a chance in Formula One. And of course he understood, and I would say through his father, dedication, and he had the added complication of the inevitable prejudice that was there.
Still, Ron?
Well, Anthony, if I say to you, do you think this country is without people who are prejudiced? I don't think you would say no. And the reality is, prejudice manifests itself in different ways. And in this instance, it was unspoken, but I had to protect and constantly advise that it served no function to spend any time worrying about it. And it's a bit of the proof of the pudding was the eating. The success in the sport was all that was needed to demonstrate that to those people who are prejudiced that you know, success is not the domain of any specific religion or colour.
Just one quick question before we move on about Lewis Hamilton. What was it, Ron, that you saw and that which has made him this phenomenal record-breaking driver? And has it changed? What's he got? Has he got better at things? And if so, what?
In that era, we were unbelievably successful. there were many moments in time where winning felt too easy. And I saw this young person with all the challenges that faced him. And I thought, well, would it be possible? Would it actually be possible to guide this person to success? And I remember the courage at which he had at 10 years old to come and introduce himself to, at one of the awards ceremonies of that time. And when he reappeared 2 years later, he had this look of determination and focus. And when he came to my office, and I asked him one single question, and that was, if we give you this opportunity, will you do everything I tell you to do? Are you going to follow religiously? If I give you the reason why, irrespective of whether you agree or not, will you do it? Because I'm here, I am only here, to build a successful racing team and to sustain its success. And my only objective is for you to be successful, but you have to listen. So he conferred with his father briefly, came back and said yes. And then to his great disappointment, I said, well, you're going back to school. And that was really, that was painful for him. I wanted, I don't know that going back to school was physically the right thing to do, but I wanted to see if he would take the pain of going back to school. And because we're being homeschooled at that point, and he did, reluctantly, of course. And through the latter parts of the career, you know, I would say, I would, as I have with my own children, I would always talk about tattoos being irrelevant and not appropriate, and normally probably most people that tattoo would regret it at a later stage or various other things. And the Singapore Grand Prix, where we were leading the race comfortably, the car failed. In fact, it was a Mercedes fuel pump that failed. He was vulnerable and disappointed, and when Niki Lauda approached him, all of this came out later, you know, he offered him two things. He offered him more money, which was definitely got his attention. But more importantly to Lewis, he offered him freedom from me. You can wear what you want, you can do what you want. And of course, first thing that happened was a tattoo, and the second thing, you know, and then it went off in all sorts of different directions. And to me, whilst, you know, that history shows he won a lot of races, or Mercedes, it wasn't initially, it didn't initially happen. I think it was a couple of years before that started to happen, where they had a dominant car. And, you know, I look back on that and I go, and now to this day, you know, we occasionally communicate, and probably I am the only person that if he asked me a question, he would listen to. Because he has become his own, he's very much his own person. But like all drivers, when they're not having success, you know, drivers, humans get insecure and they look for security by asking those people that they respect, you know, what their view is. And I'm a great believer now is I never give people advice. I always work on the principle that free advice is normally worth what you paid for it. What I do is give people an opinion. And when they form it and they listen to my opinion, it's for them to decide whether they take that opinion and use it to good effect or not.
Where would you watch the Grand Prix from? We're moving towards an end. Were you in the pit? Were you were you calm and philosophical, zen-like, Ron, or were you... were you often quite agitated?
No, I had a reputation for being completely grey. Everybody likes, you know, I actually quite like the colour grey for lots of reasons, but I was called grey. I was called grey, you know, and the fact is that, you know, why do people struggle when you explain what's quality of your decision if you're angry? What, how can you be it? Or even worse, if you're happy, how many people have accidents? They jump in the swimming pool, super happy, possibly partially drunk and break their neck. You know, emotion is a luxury, and you cannot have emotion when you are making decisions. And I had one thing that I would always be, I wanted to be responsible for the final decision on whether a car should be retired because it wasn't safe for some reason. Now, we had great engineers, and I would say the chances of me overruling an engineer is zero, you do have insecurity in engineers, and sometimes they're not affecting good judgment, but it varied year on year, of course. So my role, as far as I was concerned, was to be there to make sure that if I felt the car was unsafe for some reason or a strategy was wrong, I would actually issue an instruction. As regards strategy, I would voice an opinion, because you don't pay a strategist and then overrule them. But safety was very important.
Safety, absolutely. Physically, where would you be during the Grand Prix?
On the pit wall.
And another question, has television improved the Grand Prix experience for those watching away from the track? And if so, how? What have been the greatest changes to television technology?
Well, the first thing is, we go back to the introduction of telemetry. We used initially helicopters to transmit. And of course, the problem with helicopters is there's, first of all, Grand Prix people didn't actually like helicopters flying around, although we were able to do it, but trees would get in the way and things like that. Yeah. So there would be, then we developed a thing called data burst. And data burst meant that the car stored up its information, and then as it came past the pits, it would burst that information out. You would quickly process it. Then we came up with an understanding that if there was an optic fiber laid around every circuit, we could provide not only data for ourselves, but actually data could be provided to the other teams.
Yeah.
And from that, what happened was television signals coming from a car, and then instead of them being poor quality, they were very high quality. And followed on from that was voice quality. So television has been a pulling force, not a driving force, for very good quality images coming. And then through the advent of some good, I would say Martin Brundle, probably the best,
yep,
a former driver, understands what's going on, keeps abreast of everything, gives a good commentary. And then there's, unfortunately, some people who don't have that knowledge, who present because they have to be appealed to a different part of the audience. And I listen to them and go, well, that's a load of nonsense. Or you can listen to the sort of Brundles of this world, or Coulthards, or Damon Hills, people that have been in a car, they understand. They understand. Mm-hmm. They have to be colourful. Some of them aren't very good presenters, but they're still knowledgeable. And so I would say television is a big driving force now, primarily because the quality of the commentary and the understanding that it gives the consumer of what's going on.
Who was the standout commentator of your career, Ron?
Well, of course, the most colourful was the duo of Murray Walker and James Hunt, but that wouldn't be now. And now, definitely, I would say Martin Brundle's definitely probably the best commentator in the world in terms of Grand Prix racing.
The pit experience, what's been the biggest, was the biggest change in your career of the speed and effectiveness of the pit stop?
Well, we don't have refueling now. when we had refueling, it would determine, it would be the slowest thing that was happening. It was not necessary to change the tires as quickly as they are changed now, because the refueling took longer. I can't remember, it probably took anything up to 5-6 seconds. And it was done under great pressure. How we didn't have a bigger accident, I have no idea, because it was a very hairy process by which you refueled a Grand Prix car quickly. But now the pit stop is determined by the speed at which the mechanics can actually change a tire, which is pretty phenomenal, under 2 seconds. And I think the other thing is, between Ferrari and ourselves, we actually took the process by which we optimized pit stops and applied it into the medical field. The traditional form of triage was sequential. Everything was done. First you measure the blood pressure, then you do this, then you do that, you know. And when we started looking at that, I can't remember which A&E department of which London hospital approached us, but we could never understand why they weren't doing everything at the same time when possible. And so I think if you said, what's the best thing that ever came out of pit stop technology, it would definitely be the benefits given to A&E departments. And it's not by accident that the St. Peter's Hospital in A&E department is called the pit stop. So that's a bit of a legacy of some of the things we did.
Will electric Formula One ever be as exciting?
No. There's no such, there will be no such animal.
Why?
Well, it probably starts with the fact that I'm very skeptical about electric vehicles. I think that there is, I cannot understand why there isn't the application of logic. And what we should do is make electric vehicles mandatory in city centres where pollution is a real issue, and realise that they're not particularly well developed for travelling long distances. And of course, the problem that totally gets glossed over is that virtually every device that an electric car has, air conditioning, radio, electric windows, anything, is using energy. So I believe everybody that drives an electric car has range anxiety as being a fundamental downside of it. And then we haven't really got into the recycling challenge of batteries. I know of no recycling plant which is dedicated to recycling of car batteries, which is a huge problem. And, you know, so that's going to be a problem down the road. And as you get closer to battery life, the secondhand value of cars plummet. And right now, through the legislation in America, Europe, especially England, is being flooded with good for value Chinese cars. So if you want to get a, you know, they're many thousands of pounds cheaper than a Tesla, and probably just as, if not more efficient. But it's for me, not the future.
Last question. Founding of McLaren Automotive in 2010. Did that give you a lot of pleasure? And what was that about, Ron?
I think it was... I don't think, as a result of the... I did not think, quite early on, that the cyclical nature of Formula One is a sustainable business model for a company such as McLaren. It made no sense not to start building cars that had the same technology, the same effort to seek perfection, and purity of design with form following function, it was a logical step. But what was more logical was the fact that we were spending, I would say, in today's money, probably, I'm guessing, in today's money, something like £300 million a year. In my day, it was like £75 million a year, developing two products for two drivers. And I couldn't get my head around the fact that, of course, we were patenting all our technologies, but we weren't using them. So I pushed the company and changed the company's name into the McLaren Technology Group, which it still has today, and diversified into technology and built a business model that had technology, car manufacturing, and Formula One, in order that it could balance out the competitive and uncompetitive seasons of Formula One, which then impacted.
But
unfortunately, I didn't actually carry the opinion always of my other shareholders. But the fact is that if it wasn't for the looming 70th birthday, which was definitely going to be a decision point that I'd already made, I was going to change direction in my life, not retire. On my 70th birthday, I took that decision at my 65th birthday, and in that 5 years, pushed harder and harder to become a technology group and less of a Formula One group. And of course, what I'd inherently brought to the table was more and more shareholders who were passionate about Formula One were less passionate about being a successful conglomerate of technology companies with a car company. So you see quite a deconstructed McLaren of today.
Yeah, well, indeed. And your 70th birthday, June, was in June 2017. But just finally, Ron, how does one build a supercar when you have decades of experience of Ferrari, Lamborghini, Maserati, etc., and work so quickly to produce these dazzling cars?
We had to have a USP, which was the first real production car with a composite chassis. When I say production car, the sweet spot is you have to be able to build and sell 4,500 cars at an average price, probably today, of £250,000. And if you can hit that, you're going to be profitable.
Yep.
And you have to have the ability to constantly reinvent. And the beauty of having reestablished the, I would say, original Henry Ford process of the primary structure, in his instance, was a ladder construction chassis on which he hung all the bodywork. When we created the composite survival cell for our sports cars, the actual bodywork itself had no real torsional contribution to the car. So we were able to change the styling of the car over several years and iterate the running components, sometimes different engine gearbox configurations, keep the primary structure consistent, and and basically that gave us a technology step that the other high performance car manufacturers, Ferrari, etc., had to follow, but they followed in our footsteps. And in the few years where we had that advantage, we did make inroads into it. And it was Fiat stepping in and realizing the value of the brand Ferrari and giving it the money to grow that's just put it in an unassailable position really in that sector, and it has high value now. The company, obviously, because I sold my shares in 2017, I have a razor like memory of the value of the company on that day, contrasting with the value of the company when I bought equity in the early 80s. And I felt very proud of those financial achievements and the outcome of Grand Prix team form. But the most,
and give us those figures, Ron, if they're still fresh. Round them up.
The earlier figure was sub £50 million. The exit figure was £1.4 billion.
Quite a change. And this is the last question. And it's the question from Desert Island Discs. And it's about a luxury. But there's one thing that I'm going to insist on here, Ron. You can have your luxury to share with us before we sign off, but it has to be a car. What is the one car that you would take off to a desert island if you had to be there? I can't imagine you're on a desert island without anybody else, but...
I would say it would be obviously McLaren. It would be the very first MP4 scene. And it would be chassis 21.
Well, that is precision in your answer, precision in your entire life, your hallmark of your career. Ron Dennis, thank you so very much for being our guest.
Thank you.